Dave, I don't know if you saw this, but I did get to do something pretty special over the weekend. I got to try the Sour Patch Kid Oreos.
Yes, I saw that. Like, how am I supposed to feel about that?
I was pretty skeptical when I saw them. But, man, I tell you what, they are better than I thought they would be. There's no chocolate really in it at all, which I know sounds ridiculous for an Oreo. It actually tastes like candy, and I can't really explain how or why they did it, but the Sour Patch Kid Oreos were shockingly good.
Was it like the vanilla? Is it like a vanilla wafer, or does it really taste like a Sour Patch Kid?
It really tastes like a Sour Patch Kid. I don't know how to explain it because you don't have that powdered sugar on the exterior like you do with the normal candy, but the creamy stuff in the middle is it tastes like candy. It's almost like it's really incredible what they've done with it.
And you say it's special. Like, where they don't sell these everywhere. I don't see these very often. Where did you find them?
It's a limited edition. So what it was is I was in town. My mom is moving from Bartlett to Germantown. And so I had to help her move a bunch of stuff, which I don't know if you've ever had to, like, move out of your childhood home, but that's, like, a really weird thing.
I had to do it in high school, yep.
I mean, I haven't lived there for 13 years, but really, really weird still when you're moving and you find, like, all these old things that you had in, like, middle school and, like, just random sports memorabilia, like old team pictures and literally 10,000 baseball cards that I'm hoping have some value. Anyway, as part of this, she had gone to the grocery store and she saw these Sour Patch Kid Oreos and she was like, yeah, David would like these. So she helped me out. So I can't tell you for sure where she got them. But yeah, that was a nice little treat.
Was that the highlight of your weekend? Those Sour Patch Kids? Or do you have a tea time? What else? What else do we have going this weekend?
Yeah, the whole moving thing was weird. Like, also just the idea that I now need a GPS to get to my mother's house. Like, that's bizarre. Like, I don't know. I get weirdly sentimental about stuff like this. But, you know, growing up in Bartlett, we had this awesome backyard where we played wiffle ball. We played touch football. We had this big bonus room that had a ping pong table with it. Now, there was a downside to this, which is that, you know, it's just a normal neighborhood, but it was a corner lot. And so growing up, I mean, I had to do a half acre with the push mower, which, I mean, maybe that doesn't sound like a lot, but in the Memphis humidity in June and July, a half acre with a push mower,
that's
you know,
something.
You need to drink. Yeah, you got to drink like a gallon of water to offset, you know, all the sweat you're going to lose doing that. So I'm not going to miss that. I'm happy she's moving. But, man, it's weird, like, when you walk into the house where you grew up and all the furniture is gone and it's like, wow, this is going to belong to somebody else. So, we called it Maccabi Cove. You know how in San Francisco it's called McCovey Cove?
Yes.
So we called it Maccabi Cove, and we played a lot of wiffle ball back there. But anyway, that was what my weekend was taken up with, and the Sour Patch Kid Oreos sort of helped offset some of the mixed emotions of all that.
Yeah, I went from, in high school, we moved from out in West County, St. Louis, from Wildwood to Chesterfield. My parents now have gone from Chesterfield to San Diego, though. I think that's the more substantial. You know, that's the one that weirded me out the most, though. Seeing their new house in San Diego and the hills in Point Loma as compared to where I was for my junior and senior year of high school. And now anytime I go back to St. Louis, I look at the dining room table is now all the way moved to San Diego. So my dad's going to be there for another year, I believe, sort of back and forth. And there's like this little tiny, it shows how men can live. You know what I mean? Like, men can be happy with like a cardboard box holding up their TV and one like chair. My dad's dining room table right now is like this outdoor little tiny table that goes up to about my knee if I'm standing straight up. And he's got a foldable chair and he has covered the whole thing with like one of my little sister's old Elsa like table covers. It's phenomenal.
So Bartlett to Germantown is a nice little upgrade, you know, for my mom. But I think St. Louis to San Diego, that's
it might take the cake.
Yes. Yeah, so going to visit out there, that'll be nice. Now, granted, it is nice when you're within driving distance of the folks, but I feel like if your folks are going to move across the country, San Diego is about as good of a place as you could ask for. You fly out there, and then you're just flying into this beautiful, like, weather oasis where Memphis, St. Louis, like, you're always dealing with the humidity, the weird weather, tornado watches all the time. But, like, San Diego, Southern California, like, not sure I could live out there. It's just a different vibe. But, it is a great place.
Well, San Diego, I think you – have you ever been to San Diego? I don't think you can compare it to L.A. It's a slower L.A. It's way better. Better speed.
It is. Yeah, I did get to go to a game at Petco Park.
Oh, might be best stadium in California, too. And we just talked about McCovey Cove and San Fran. Might be the best stadium in California.
Right. Petco. So, yeah, I'm happy for you. I'm happy for your parents. That's a great place to end up.
Yeah, I'm still impressed with it every time I show up. It beats the hell out of getting a Airbnb or a hotel out there. I can tell you that.
Yeah, but it does. But you do miss out on, like, I don't know how big of a Cardinals guy you are, but, like, it's nice, like, for me, like, you know, I've been in and out of Memphis a lot over the last few years, and it's always nice to, like, be able to come home and, like, oh, like, not that I do it all the time, but, oh, I could go down and catch a Redbirds game, and that's, like, a nice little comfort thing, or a Grizzlies game, obviously, you know. I don't know, are you going to, like, try to form an allegiance to the Padres or something now?
No, I mean, I've always been an okay fan of the Padres. They've never bothered me as a Cardinals fan. I'm still going to be a Cardinals fan, though. I cannot change allegiances. My whole entire life has been dedicated to the St. Louis Cardinals. I used to go to, I mean, my during my high school days, probably 30 games a year. It's hard to change an allegiance when you've given that much sweat equity, that many you've bought that many tickets.
Yeah, I found a bunch of random old Cardinals stuff, too, while moving, because that summer when I interned for MLB.com, mm-hmm. one of the coolest parts of being in that press box is you get all the promotional items. They bring them through the press box. And so, you know, it's one of those deals where the first 5,000 fans get them, but they always had them in the press box, too. So I got, like, Ozzie Smith bobbleheads. I've got, like, batting practice jerseys. I've got random baseball cards from, like, the 2015 team. So if you need any random Cardinals trinkets to, like, outfit your man cave or something, let me know.
That place, I'll have to take you up on that. Now, David, I want to hop into this real quick first. Celtics versus Mavs in the NBA Finals. Celtics up 2-0, and they're rolling, quite frankly. They just look like they're too deep on both ends of the floor. Do you feel like the Celtics are going to run away with this thing, or do you think the Mavs have a little push in them? I was surprised to see, because after game one, what you say consistently is, oh, you know, Kyrie was 6-for-19. He's not going to shoot like that again. He does the exact same thing in game two, only has another, 12 to 14 points. It was not very good. But do you feel like the Celtics are going to run away with this thing?
No, let's see what the Mavericks look like on their home floor before we read them their last rites. I mean, game two, I did the math on this. Players not named Luka Doncic were 2 of 17 from three. And one of those makes was very early on from PJ Washington. So they basically went the entire game with one made three-pointer from their supporting cast. And overall, I think they're hovering around 25% shooting from deep over the first couple of games. You get them back in their home gym, on their home floor with that home crowd, Dallas hits 15 threes, all of a sudden I think the series looks a lot different. I mean, I think, you know, it's the old adage of a series doesn't really begin until somebody loses on their home floor. So I'm not ready to say that it's over just because the Celtics, jumped out to this 2-0 lead. I mean, obviously they look like the better team, but they should look like the better team when they've got home court advantage.
Yes, I'll say this, though. Okay, so Kyrie had his 16 points. So far against the Celtics this season, though, he has not been good. 21 points, 5 rebounds, 2.5 assists. That's just not that great for Kyrie Irving as far as numbers are concerned.
Yeah, he's, I think, 0-12 since he stomped on the Celtic logo.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
I saw that. That's via X. Verify that. You know,
yes.
But, like, still, I think it's true, and it's kind of hilarious. I think it's also difficult for Kyrie to score against those Boston defenders. Like, we talked a lot going into this NBA Finals about how much better the Mavericks got defensively over the course of this season. One, really haven't seen that. And then two, it feels to me like it's the Celtics who have the better perimeter defenders in this series, because Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are really proven difficult for the Mavericks to contain defensively. And so, I mean, it just seems to me like Kyrie's size versus the size of Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum is like a big differentiator in what they're able to create off the dribble.
Yeah, and do you care to chime in on the Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown debate right now? Because we had Jason Kidd before game two basically say, well, Jaylen Brown's the best player on the team. I think Jason Tatum has struggled from the floor. He settles too much. He takes fall-away jumpers like it's going out of style, and it should be going out of style if you look at how efficient he is on those. But he did have, what, 12 assists? He almost had a triple-double, 18, 9, and 12 in game two. Do you care to comment on Jaylen Brown versus Jason Tatum, or are we're going to wait?
Jason Kidd might not be wrong about that. I mean, we'll see how the rest of the series goes, but I mean, Jaylen Brown's been really good. I flash back to game one, man. I forget who he took off the dribble, but then he elevated and dunked on two different people.
It felt like the whole team he took off the dribble on that particular play.
And I'm just like, oh, my gosh. Like, that's a level of athletic explosiveness that I normally reserve in my mind for a John Morant or an Anthony Edwards.
Right.
And you don't see Jason Tatum making a play that involves that much athleticism attacking the rim all that often. So, I think if we were doing a fantasy draft or something, you'd probably still take Jason Tatum as the guy to build your franchise around. But that doesn't mean I also thought Jason Tatum was pretty good defensively last night in game two. But dang, I mean, Jaylen Brown, he's playing better right now than I ever recall him playing in the playoffs previously.
Yeah. Now I have to hop into this going in. It was still talking about Danny Hurley, the NBA. He said that when he met with the Lakers made a compelling case as to why he should be the coach of the Los Angeles Lakers going forward. Some of the contract details have been reported or rumored. 8 years, $100 million. I can say over $10 million a year is a compelling case enough.
No doubt. No, it's you have to pay attention to the money at some point, even if it's all just astronomical to us. Like, you know, you and I, we can't even fathom, making what Dan Hurley makes at UConn. But, think about it. If you make $6 million and if somebody offers you $12 million, double your salary, maybe this would even do more than that because, think about the commitment. And the other part of it is, like, how much of that would be guaranteed. So it almost makes it like a no-risk proposition, if you're Dan Hurley and you get that offer. But the trade-off for that is obviously the comfort, the legacy, the immortality that is available to him at UConn. And how do you put a price tag on that?
Right.
How do you put a price tag on the ability to pursue a three-peat? How do you put a price tag on being the guy who they're going to build a statue of? How do you put a price tag on having a chance to go toe-to-toe with John Wooden for greatest college basketball coach of all time? Because that's the element of legacy that's available to Dan Hurley, by staying at UConn. And for as much as adding NBA championships, to his resume would add to his legacy as a coach in total, there's no guarantee that he wins one. We're talking about a Lakers franchise that's going to be moving on from LeBron James in the very near future, merely due to age, if nothing else. And then what do the Lakers even look like in a post-LeBron era? That's got to be part of the pitch if I'm Dan Hurley and I'm listening to the Lakers is, okay, yeah, we got LeBron here for a year, maybe two, whatever, but what does life as a part of the Lakers franchise even look like once he's gone? Who are we going to get? Who's on the top of the list to trade for or to sign in free agency? And so that's got to be a part of the pitch to me if I'm even entertaining that Lakers offer.
Well, the thing is, like, I think he'd be great with the young team, Danny Hurley, and I think he'd be really good at rebuilding the Lakers, getting his culture there instilled with young players in a rebuild. But the problem is, it's still the NBA. And in the NBA, when you take over a rebuild, when you try to build with young players, the likelihood of you getting fired on the back end is very high. Right? You become expendable at times if you're not able to get over the hump in a rebuild in, what, 3-4 years?
And there's just not a lot of appetite in these big market NBA franchises for
that full-on rebuild.
Yeah, exactly. So you that's the way in this day and time is to start from scratch and build from the ground up. It's sort of the the way to build in professional sports, in particular in the NBA. But does a franchise like the Lakers, do they really have an appetite for that? I'm not so sure. And if they do, you have to be patient. And then, you know, what's the allure of being a Lakers fan if you're going to have a 3-year deal where we're just trying to build towards the play-in or whatever it is? I mean, who's your star rookie or your star young player that you're going to be able to market? I don't know. I got a lot of questions about, you know, a Dan Hurley Lakers fit. So it just doesn't seem like a no-brainer to me, aside from the fact that there's this massive financial commitment and money talks. And so how much does that talk to Dan Hurley? I don't know. This is a guy who was a high school basketball coach 20 years ago. This is a guy who was raised by a high school basketball coach who saw firsthand that a legacy isn't comprised merely of dollars. You think Dan Hurley's father's legacy in Dan's mind has anything to do with the amount of money that he made as a high school coach in New Jersey? No, not at all. It has everything to do with the relationships that he built with the players and the program that he built. And so I think that stuff speaks to Dan Hurley, you know, as much as money and as the glamorous life in Southern California. But on the flip side, it's a chance to maybe go and do something different for the preeminent basketball brand, you know, in the United States. And so I understand why that's a difficult decision.
He cracks me up. He really is an insane person, though. You see some of the interviews that he's had in the past about, like, oh, yeah, I've won 2 straight national championships, but he will still talk about how bad he was as a player back in the day. And they ask him, like, why do you still think about that? And he'll say, I'm built different. I'm just truly built different. He still hangs around and talks about how bad he was as a player, even though he's probably the best coach of the bunch. Of his family, considering what he's been able to accomplish.
Right. So he wasn't the best player. His brother was the better player, obviously at Duke. And Dan Hurley was a bit of an afterthought, the little brother who wasn't as good of a player. And it's funny how it works out, because Bobby Hurley is kind of struggling at Arizona State to keep them, you know, above water and competing for NCAA tournament bids. And, you know, obviously the little brother, you get a little bit of a chip on your shoulder.
Yes.
And that's obviously carried him a long way. If you strip away some of the sideline antics and stuff and just get to spend a little time around Dan Hurley as a coach and as a person, you know, he is very entertaining and interesting and surprisingly personable for somebody who has had that amount of success, who has that last name. He's more relatable and down to earth than like a Mike Krzyzewski or a Roy Williams and these legends who just had this sort of aura about them. Even a Bill Self, I would say, you know, Dan Hurley, you're more likely to have a casual conversation with him in the hallway at the Final Four than you are with any of the people who share that rarefied air of being a multi-time national champion.
Yep, for sure, for sure. Now, I don't know if you had a golf tee time today, but I'm sure you watched over the weekend Scottie Scheffler win the Memorial, and it's just like he survived on Sunday because Mirfield Village was impossible. It was ridiculous. He had one shot. He wins over Colin Morikawa, shot of 74 on Sunday. But this guy, like this run he's on, is as legendary as I remember in my lifetime. 5th win in 8 starts. He won $4 million yesterday, getting first. That's $24 million for the year, breaking the PGA Tour season earnings record that he set last year, and he broke his own record last year. So he has gone 3 straight years breaking his own record for earnings on the PGA Tour. He just brought a newborn into the world. He was arrested a month ago. This guy is on a tear. Like it is a legendary tear he is on.
Right. There's this old prevailing thought in golf circles that once a PGA Tour professional becomes a father, that it immediately correlates with a downturn in their playing abilities.
Didn't look like McElroy. It.
Yeah, how many majors has Rory won since he became a father?
Right.
Zero. But obviously that has not impacted Scottie's game whatsoever. And I need to learn what Scottie did, because Gabe I'm going to be entering the dad game
right
in November.
Yes, and for those that don't know, we need to wish congrats to David Kopp.
Thank you. I'm excited. And I'm soaking it up this year while I can and getting out to the range and to the course as much as possible, because you hear that once you become a dad, your time to play golf starts to diminish. I'll say that. A little different for Scottie Scheffler, considering that he is a professional player, but nonetheless, for all the reasons you mentioned, including becoming a father, it's insane what he's accomplishing. And I'm a little annoyed by the arrest, because it might have robbed us of something even more spectacular, because, yeah, he came out the day after, the day of the arrest, and played really well that day. But you could tell for his, I believe it was his third round the next day, he was running on fumes. His caddy wasn't even there. Ted Scott had to go home for his daughter's high school graduation. So he was running on fumes. He didn't have his caddy. And that probably deprived us of seeing him win the PGA Championship. And, you know, considering, if he had won that, he would at least be in the running or have a chance to complete the Grand Slam this year. But nonetheless, I think what happened to him actually sort of elevates the level of intrigue and interest in watching Scottie Scheffler. Because when he won the Masters, I was saying, I like Scottie Scheffler. I think he's a great guy. But, man, sometimes it's a little boring to watch him. But now that he's, now that we have his mugshot on the internet, it makes him a little bit more interesting to watch. And I think it's helped the fans sort of rally behind him a little bit.
Yeah. Now, final thing for David Cobb, at David W. Cobb on X, CBS Sports, covering college football, college basketball, college athletics in general. The College World Series has been very it's been compelling, not the College World Series. I should say the NCAA tournament and the Super Regionals. But getting through, you have North Carolina, Florida State, Virginia. Then you have the SEC flavor. Florida A&M, Kentucky gets through. First College World Series berth in program history. Tennessee gets through, of course. And, their home run numbers, their power numbers for a college team, it's ridiculous. 26 home runs and 6 NCAA tournament games. And then we have one spot left, and it's NC State visiting Georgia at 6 p.m. tonight, so not that long after we'll get off the phone. But Georgia could be the fifth team out of 8 that makes it the College World Series from the SEC. The flavor is unbelievable. The SEC is completely taken over.
Yeah, it's going to be an ACC-SEC challenge in Omaha, basically, regardless of who wins the NC State-Georgia game, because it's either going to be 4 from the ACC and 4 from the SEC, or 5 from the SEC and 3 from the ACC. So a concentrated. They ought to just pack up from Omaha and put the dang thing in Atlanta,
right,
or something. Or let's see, can AutoZone Park host the College World Series?
I'd be down.
I know. But you're going to have a lot of fan bases traveling from the Southeast to the Midwest for that thing. And it's just more evidence of sort of where I think college baseball in particular is, where you've seen the SEC's dominance more evidently over the last 5-6 years. Think about it. I mean, Michigan's been there. College football, the reigning national champion, is not an SEC team in football. You had UConn's run of dominance in college basketball in the Big East. And so really it's baseball where we've seen the SEC flex its muscle in this new power conference, super conference sort of era. So, yeah, Omaha is going to be, there's not going to be an underdog. There's not going to be a Coastal Carolina or one of those Cinderella types of stories there. It's just going to be the big boys.
Yeah, and then Clemson versus Florida game 2, that was phenomenal. Oh, 13 innings, Florida ended up getting over top. But the Cam Cannarella catch in center field, and he had a bomb earlier in the game, but that Cam Cannarella catch, the Willie Mays-style catch, was the highlight of the weekend. That was crazy. I guess baseball fans don't really, some people that don't watch baseball all the time can't really understand the degree of difficulty on that. But a lot of people that have played in the outfield and seen something hit right at them, they can understand and relate with how the degree of difficulty on that catch was insane.
Right. So there were 2 outs. If Clemson gave up a run, they were going to lose. So there was a runner on second, which means he was playing super shallow, because in his mind, he's trying to get the single up the middle and then throw the guy out at the plate. So he's playing way closer towards second base as the center fielder than he normally would under any circumstances. And then he gets this bomb hit all the way to the wall. So he's got to cover I haven't seen the analytics on how much ground he covered, but I got to think it's in the neighborhood of 150 feet, maybe 100, to get all the way back to the wall. They don't have a warning track.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no warning track at Clemson, too. That's the terrifying part.
And they got this little hill out there, too, this little slope, a unique feature as well. So certainly helps that that's his home ballpark, and he's been patrolling that yard all year long. But that's the catch of the year in baseball. I've not seen one better in the major leagues or at any level this year to make that catch. And then the moment when he did it, it's just a shame that Clemson wasn't able to hold on and get it done. And I get a little annoyed because Clemson's the host for that Super Regional, but Florida's the home team in that game. I don't get that. Like, if you're hosting, you should be the home team. It's strange to me that they would give the visiting team the privilege of being the last at bat in a Super Regional setting. I don't love that, and that kind of hurt Clemson a little bit there. But still, nonetheless, that guy's going to remember that catch for a long, long time.
And we will, too. That was, even though they lost, that was nuts. That was absolutely crazy. But, David, I appreciate it, man. We'll go ahead and let you roll, and we will talk on Wednesday.
All right, man. Thanks.
Yes, sir. It is David Cobb at David W. Cobb on X. College basketball, college football writer for CBS Sports. Let's go ahead and grab a break right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, but we have more coming up on the other side right here on 92.9 FM. The UConn head coach that has gone back-to-back national titles in college basketball. He has officially turned down the Lakers' offer. Now, I think there's three particular reasons that he turned this thing down. And one, to me, I think the Lakers screwed up on. I really do think the Lakers screwed up on. We got a lot of, you know, intel and reporting that it was going to be 8 years, $100 million, somewhere 6 to 8 years, $100 million, which is a lot of money. But also, if you get to that point, you show an amount of security. You show that even after this LeBron and AD thing goes, I know we want to win a championship. Even though your roster's not there, I think most people accept that. You want to show that you're going to give him long-term security. And 6 years, $70 million doesn't give him that same runway and that same leeway that he thought that he was going to get, that we thought he was going to get. So I think, first of all, he's so secure at UConn. He's a statuesque head coach. You have to offer him 8 to 10 years for him to ultimately take that job with the Lakers, because you're saying, even after this LeBron and AD thing's up, we're going to give you time to rebuild with us. We're going to go try to find another star for you. We're going to give you a chance to get your culture in. I don't know if 6 years, $70 million did the trick in that regard. I think, too, and this is probably the most important thing, Rob Pelinka, Jeannie Buss, and all of the different moving pieces, I should say. Well, easy for me to say. But all the different moving pieces in that Lakers front office and in the Lakers ownership, it keeps you from having your own say. It keeps you from having your own say. And we've seen here in the past, like, LeBron can definitely influence some things. AD can influence some things. Rob Pelinka, Jeannie Buss, Kurt Rambis, like, all these Clutch. Different names. Clutch. They all sway things behind the scenes if you're the Lakers head coach. And you have to answer to them consistently. Whereas at UConn right now, with the success he's seeing, he gets to add who he wants. He tells the NIL collective, hey, pay this guy. They pay this guy. They get to campus. He puts together good rosters. He moves forward. He doesn't really have to answer to those UConn higher-ups because he's doing such a damn good job. Whereas with the Lakers, if you run into some rough patches, it becomes hell. Just ask Darvin Ham. Makes the Western Conference Finals in year one. Second year, he was supposed to be fired from about game 35 on. And it was always hung over his head the entire time. I don't know if Danny Hurley wants that in the slightest. And then the third thing, and this is probably the smallest thing here, is the geographical footprint. He is an East Coast guy. His wife is an East Coast girl. They're from Jersey. His whole family is from Jersey. It's a strange fit for him to go out to L.A. with the speed of that city and try to fit in. It's just not who he is as a guy. And that was something I always mentioned through this entire process, is I think that that could come into the equation here, because a lot of his family's out there on the East Coast. That's long. You have to take a red eye. You have to do all that stuff. I think the geographical footprint definitely played into this. And then also, like, you just look at, like, $10 million a year, or a little bit of $11.6 million a year, that's taxed pretty well in California. I think that whatever, the $4.6 million he's going to get at UConn, I think by the end of taxes, probably very similar to what he would get with the Lakers, like $6 million per year if he's getting that 11.6. So I think all three of those things came into consideration here. But Danny Hurley not going to be the coach, and now the Lakers have to circle the wagons, figure out what they're going to do.
I agree with everything that you just said, and that's why when the number came out, what they offered him, I just laughed at it. That it just feels like a massive fumble by the Los Angeles Lakers, because if you offer him $8,100, that's the type of money that generationally save like goes to your family. You can't really turn that down.
$670 is too, but it like is, the but eight for me.
To your point, though,
is the point
with everything that you talked about, you'd have to pull him away from being an East Coast guy, pull him away from trying to go for back to back to back in college basketball, his connections there. $8,100, that's the type of money that brings somebody out of that, that says, okay, I have all these connections here. I want to try to go, you know, do the three-peat. I'm an East Coast guy, but, I mean, that's $8,100. That's $100 million that can go toward our family. It'll go toward our grandkids eventually. That's just the type of money that you can't turn down, and I just don't understand why the Lakers would allow the rumor of that contract to get out there and then offer him $6 for $70. You offered $600,000 more than Kentucky. What the hell are y'all doing? It just feels like a huge misstep by the Lakers, and it, to be quite honest, it's a bit surprising, but it's also, I think, embarrassing for the Lakers, because now you have to kind of backtrack, and you're like, James Borrego, JJ, and then it came out that they haven't even interviewed JJ.
Yes.
It just feels like this has all of a sudden become a bit of a circus.
Yes, and I think
because Hurley would have been an amazing
hire. This is how you know when a team's going to strike out on who they want as a head coach is when Jay Wright's name comes up. Jay Wright is not coming out of retirement to go coach the Los Angeles Lakers right now. I'm sorry.
He's like the Grim Reaper for coaching searches.
They may reach out to him, but he's not coming. It's like Bob Stoops at the college football level. He's not going to do it for you. So just get it out of your mind. He's not going to come back to coach it. He'll do it for Oklahoma and be like a associate head coach for a firing or whatever if somebody's out. But he's not – like, Jay Wright's not coming out of retirement to go coach the Los Angeles Lakers. But, like, now it does bring up the question, is the Lakers' job even that good at this particular moment?
No, probably not.
When we talk about brand, sure, yeah. And the amount of money you're going to get, sure. And it's a fine place to live, I guess, out there on the West Coast in L.A. You have the beaches. You have a lot of things to do. It's, one of the entertainment capitals of the world, the entertainment capital of the world. So, like, I will give L.A. credit for that. But the Lakers in general, like I mentioned with the, having your own say, if you're Danny Hurley, there's just too many cooks in the kitchen there. And it really limits what that job is supposed to be.
Right.
And I think that the Dallas Cowboys, who are another institution in the NFL, the richest franchise in the entire world, that's another team. That's another sort of situation where you have this great brand that's won championships in the past, but there's too many cooks in the kitchen. There's a lot of coaches that are hesitant about ultimately hopping into that because it's just too much. They're pulled in so many different directions. It doesn't seem like it's on stable footing right now. I think that's where we're at with the Lakers. You're uncomfortable taking that job because of how many people you have to answer to, and the money better be damn good if you're going to take it.
Well, I think we can be honest about it. The Lakers. The only reason we even consider them okay right now is because LeBron went there. Like, imagine the Lakers franchise if LeBron had never gone there. It would be in the depths of hell right now, and it feels like that they're getting close to it because they have no real plan for post-LeBron right now, and that's why this Dan Hurley thing, 6 for $70 is just not enough money to make it worth dealing with all the cooks in the kitchen, dealing with the move, like separating from that college team. It's just they had to make it worth it, and that's why, to your point, I don't understand why the second, third most valuable franchise in the NBA is penny-pinching right now. You had an opportunity to make a big splash. You had an opportunity to get a coach that would excite your fan base and can also help you get ready for the future post-LeBron because that's coming fast, and you just fumbled it away by being like, nah, we're going to lowball him. Like, what the hell are y'all doing? It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Yes, and sometimes I think there's just situation where these franchises, I brought up the Cowboys and the Lakers, I think that there's an arrogance about their brand.
We're the Lakers, so they should want to come coach for us. It's
exactly.
Like, okay.
There's an arrogance about the brand that I think's off-putting as well.
Yeah, y'all just keep firing winning coaches.
That's the point. That's another thing that is just so off-putting about that job in particular. It's Jeannie Buss, they hold that brand in such high regard that they just expect you to fall into line, and that's not how it ultimately works. Now, I do think that going into the future, regardless of who the head coach is, regardless of when LeBron moves away, I still think they're going to be able to, trade for or acquire a superstar. Because
maybe.
People want to go to L.A. They want the players, they know they're going to get paid if they go to L.A. They're going to get their max contract, and they can live in L.A. It's a good spot for them to be in. But coaching-wise, these coaches, it's just the expectations, all the cooks in the kitchen, the arrogance they have about their brand, it is very off-putting. Now, where do they turn now? Where do they turn now? Apparently, J.J. Redick never got an interview.
That's crazy.
Even though Shams said he was the front runner to get the job. How are you a front runner to get the job if you haven't even had a sit down with the higher ups at the damn organization?
Is Shams cooked?
And then also, the other one is James Borrego. Those are the two names that have been surfaced now that Danny Hurley's out of the running. James Borrego, though, if you'll pay attention, the Cavs may move on him sooner rather than later. So he may be out of the running, and you're left with J.J. Redick, who has never coached. The step down in quality. And I love J.J. Redick. I like J.J. Redick a lot more than other people. I think some people think he comes across as arrogant and maybe a little out of touch, whatever. I think he's a really good basketball mind. But the step down from Danny Hurley to J.J. Redick is a steep one.
It's significant.
It's a huge one. He's never coached. Never coached. Never been an assistant. I don't even know if he's coached youth basketball, for God's sakes, for kids. Best of luck to the Lakers. It feels like J.J. Redick's going to probably get an interview at some point, and they may move on it soon.
It's very funny to me to think that the Cleveland Cavaliers are now connected to James Borrego. And I know that they were in the past, but it just makes me laugh to think about that Dan Gilbert this morning may have seen the news about Hurley turning him down, was like, we must sign Borrego as soon as possible now to take him away from LeBron. Like, that spite, the potential spite hire by the Cavaliers is just a very funny scenario for me, even though he makes a lot of sense for the Cavs.
LeBron would want J.J. Redick more than
James
Borrego.
No, for sure. The funniest way this all ends, though, is Frank Vogel.
No, what I don't get, though,
that's the funniest timeline, is that, you know, you have to go back to Frank Vogel and be like, hey, man, you want to come back?
No, one of the big things in this entire conversation that has been kind of a turnoff is, like, you see a lot of these talkers, these people that talk about these things every day, NBA analysts, whoa, Shams. They'll say, you know, LeBron, he's been told to take a step back.
Yeah,
he's
sure.
He's not the one that's, you know, fielding these coaches and having to sign off on everything, yada, yada, yada. Well, if that's the case, why is J.J. Redick even considered?
Right.
Like, that's what I can't get over. It just feels like there's this insulating of LeBron in this whole thing. But if J.J. Redick's a candidate, LeBron is the one who made that happen. There's no other way to put it.
It's driving me absolutely insane that we are getting reports from people from L.A. that are like, LeBron James is taking a step back, and he has not told the Lakers what to do at all with the coaching. Yeah, I'm 6 feet tall, too. Like, get the hell out of here.
And then J.J. Redick is one of the main coaching hires that they could potentially make. And Bronny James, he's doing two damn visits and two workouts.
But LeBron
and one
has
of them's
nothing
with the
to
Lakers.
Do with it. He has nothing to do with the Gabe Kuhn. They told
us. I don't get it.
They told us.
That is LeBron doing PR for himself, telling all of his media friends, if they want access to him and his clutch and everything else, say this. Say this for me. That's been very frustrating through this whole thing. If LeBron was not involved, a lot of the things we're seeing would not have happened.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Now,
nasty.
Going back to Hurley, are they building the statue as we speak right now at UConn? Because he has turned down Kentucky and the Lakers in one offseason. They should carry him everywhere on campus. His feet should never touch the ground.
I think that's insane.
That's wild.
This is crazy. This honestly.
Imagine telling somebody
more,
like 20 years ago.
The more you peel back the layers of what Danny Hurley just did, the more historical it's going to, like, it's going to age very well. It's
if he wins again this year, holy crap.
This is a historical offseason for a college coach to stay in stores and turn down the L.A. Lakers and Kentucky basketball. Has anyone ever done that? I don't think so.
Probably
I think he's the first in history to have ever done that with those two brands. Probably the biggest brand in college basketball, biggest brand in NBA basketball.
I wonder if, you know, he was getting, because if you're the Hurley family, imagine you're seeing all these rumors about what this potential contract would be, is you're expecting, okay, they might offer me $100 million. That's going to be something that we absolutely have to consider. You sit down and they slide in front of you 70, I would have just gotten up and left the room.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is this? Is this the contract for Redick?
I still think I still think with the way NBA coaching, you know, it turns over, if an East Coast job comes undone and they fire somebody, Danny Hurley may be way more apt to take one of those jobs. 76ers, the Knicks, something like that. That would make a lot of sense for him, in my opinion. And I don't know if they'd lowball him in those particular situations.
Probably not.
Like the Lakers.
Knicks have more money than the Lakers do. It is James Dolan.
Do you really want to work with James Dolan?
That's the hard part about kind of being a pseudo Knicks fan now, because I'm like, oh, they got James Dolan. It's an awkward thing to have to deal with.
Yeah. Clipped is going on right now. I wonder how it was to be a Clippers fan back then with Donald Sterling.
Oh, we can ask the five of them that exist.
Yeah, that is true.
There are dozens of us. Dozens! Stupid Clippers.
Yeah, but let's go ahead and grab a break on that note. When we come back, we'll go ahead and hop into small talk, and it's going to be about TV shows and marketing, in particular one that is going to release its second season coming up on Sunday, House of the Dragon. Very interesting marketing strategy that they threw out there today. We'll talk about it next.
Here on 92.9, we talk ball every weekday from 4 till 7 p.m. Except right now, it's time for Big Man Small Talk on 92.9's Gabe Kuhn Show.
And Small Talk is brought to you by Conway Services, reputable service available 7 days a week. Now, Connor, are you into House of the Dragon coming up on Sunday, season 2?
So I'm not into House of the Dragon, but I have
a reason
why. That surprises
me, but you're a Game of Thrones guy. Come on,
I'm a massive Game of Thrones guy. I was highly disappointed by the final season, so I just don't like to talk about that final season. But the reason I have a short story for you real quick.
Okay, short story.
The reason I'm not a House of the Dragon guy has nothing to do with the quality of the show, because I've seen the show and I think it's excellent every single time I've actually been able to watch it. At the time of season one was when I was transitioning and going into the job at Rhodes when I was the SID there. And I was the new kid in school, so what I would do is I would watch House of the Dragon on my lunch break every single week when it would come out. So I started watching on my lunch break. And, you know, I don't need to go into the details. Some people know. Rhodes was a very trying time of my life. It was a very hectic schedule, busy schedule. I was working 70 days in a row, stuff like that, 12-hour days.
It was a very tough time to be an SID.
And let's just say that some of the harshness of that schedule or what I was feeling at that time, it got tied to House of the Dragon. So now every time I've gone back to watch it, I feel like I'm forgetting to do something and I get high anxiety. And I think it's because when I was introduced to the show, I was in an environment that brought me high anxiety.
Okay,
I have some like Freudian and psychological ties to it that I need to break through. I got to break through that wall, but I've heard it's fantastic. The last episode I actually saw was with the crab guy or something. He had just shown up. So I think I only made it like 3 or 4 episodes in. So I need to push through my past
in a better spot.
I'm in a better spot. I'm happy now.
Right?
We're happy. We're good. We're rolling.
So you're good.
Very pleased to be back in 99.
I'm hyped up. And I know my wife has been like begging for it to come out because she doesn't watch a lot of shows with me, like, just to be completely honest with you, because I watch a couple episodes at a time. I hate to be this guy, and I know how bad I am. You're going to hate when I say this. I'm a watch-ahead guy. I just like watching.
That's okay. I've always been okay with that. As long as you're willing to rewatch with her.
Yes, but she hates that. She doesn't like it. She's like, you already know it. She wants us to experience at the same time. And I'm like, I don't know. You're asking a lot of me.
Have you ever tried to do the watch it, don't tell her that you've watched it, and then watch it with her and pretend?
I do. Almost every time, and somehow she has like a sixth sense about it.
Well, it's what gets
it.
People a lot is they forget.
Well, honestly, after like the first 15 times, she just knows I watched
it. Sure, but what gets a lot of people is they forget to rewind the episode because it will show that you watched it. You got to rewind. You got to rewind, everybody. It's like Blockbuster.
That was my first mistake the first couple of times I watched it.
Why is the red bar all the way? Oh, somebody saw a workout.
Yeah,
somebody got a workout.
What the hell?
100%.
It wasn't me. It wasn't me.
Yeah, true. I experienced this with Stranger Things.
But House of the Dragon season 2 is coming out on Sunday, and they're trying to find ways to market it, even though I don't really think they need to market it all.
Everybody's gonna watch it.
But this is really cool. Everybody thought House of Dragons posted on their X account and their social media account the Westeros, which is the far west region of the realm of Game of Thrones. They threw up the Westeros banners on the Brooklyn Bridge. Everyone thought that they were real, but they were just CGI. And this has been the main discussion of the entire day around, you know, entertainment and marketing. And I thought it was a really good ploy. I mean, they're getting so creative on how to go market shows and movies in general that I'm just impressed by this one. Because even though it was CGI, it created an absolute buzz about Sunday.
It's also, the Empire State Building did it. There's a couple of landmarks across the world that did it as well in different countries. So I think they did a tremendous job by doing this. And yeah, it's very funny, though, that some people were like, they actually hung the band. Of course it's CGI.
It would be pretty cool if they didn't hang the banner, though.
It'd be really cool if they did, but yeah, of course it's CGI. But no, I think that this is a fantastic marketing, you know, strategy to have for a new show coming out, even though I feel like everybody's going to watch it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we think about some of the marketing. The one that really comes to mind to me all the time is the movie Smile, even though I've never seen it.
Man.
The one where they just had, like,
creepy-ass movie.
At games, they have people just smiling the entire time behind home plate.
Well, remember the creator had the fake, or had the AI fans for the Chargers?
Oh, that was pretty cool. I mean, yeah, that was interesting, too. But, like, they are getting very, very into it when it comes to the marketing. And it was a great – the Chargers, we've already talked about that. The AI fans, they needed the AI
fans. They needed the AI fans, yes.
Again, it's like you talked about the Clippers having no fans, dozens of them. That's what Chargers fans are. They're the Clippers fans of the football world there in L.A. But I thought that was really cool. You need to get over it, though.
I think part of it, too, is, though, the season got a bit spoiled for me, because it's hard to avoid clips when, you know, I'm in movie and TV Twitter as much as I am. It's very difficult to avoid clips, especially when I'm not super concerned about being spoiled with it. But I know what happened in the last episode with somebody flying a dragon, and then another dragon showed up.
And then that happened. And then
I will say my mouth dropped when I saw that. Whenever I watched that clip, that was absolutely insane. So it seems like the next season, correct me if I'm wrong, is just going to be two blonde people raining terror upon.
There's
going to
be bloodbath.
The realm.
It's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bloodbath. But that's what Game of the Main comes.
Have you ever experienced watching Game of Thrones with somebody for the first time that doesn't know what's about to happen? Isn't it a glorious experience? Oh, really? Yeah, I did it with Kat. It was awesome.
It's so great.
I will never forget. So when I started watching Game of Thrones, it was still when I was at the University of Tennessee. I was a sophomore. I was living in the fraternity house. And my roommate, Adrian, shout out Adrian. Yo, Adrian. We got snowed in. It was that huge snowstorm that happened, you know, I guess 9-8 years ago now. And we got snowed in, and I was like, you know what? I've never watched Game of Thrones. I need to. And I think it was only in season 5 at this time, if I was going to guess correctly. But Adrian had seen it before. So when we started watching it together, the reason I would know something bad was going to happen is I would just notice him staring at me.
Yes.
Like, all of a sudden, it was great to have him there because it's so confusing to try to talk about Game of Thrones and to get the lore and to get all the history.
Right.
So he would pause it and explain things, and he was an unbelievable resource to have while I was watching it. But I will never forget. See, at the end of season 1, I think I said a comment about, like, loving Ned Stark, and he was just like, uh-oh. And
yes,
I was like, what do you mean, uh-oh?
Yeah.
And then when the red thing happened, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who may not have seen it. It still feels like something
that you
could spoil.
Your damn dog just died, like, in real life.
Dude, we started the episode, and he never stopped looking at me. And I was like, what is about to happen right now? And then when it happened, thank God we were snowed in already. I don't think I talked to somebody. I think I went silent for 24 hours. It was like watching your family die on screen. It was horrific.
Your hero dying.
Well, you're just like
the main protagonist.
All
that
of your
you
favorite characters are just gone.
The one thing I will say about Game of Thrones that just like
it's the noise. The noise.
The thing about Game of Thrones is obviously it's tragic. Don't get it twisted. But like the character arcs and the who you want to win never actually wins. And then when that person wins, and I know I'm speaking in generalities. When that person wins, you're like, damn, should we have wanted her to win, Khaleesi, the entire time? My favorite moment, though, watching it back when my wife was watching it for the first time, is her loving Khaleesi through the entire thing and, like, you know, seeing how much tragedy she has gone through this entire time. Then she takes over the city and burns everybody to the ground. And the look on my wife's face of just absolute terror, like, my hero just turned into a villain directly before my eyes.
Man, in the moment.
It's insane.
I was trying to defend that last season in the moment because I'm the type.
No, I couldn't.
I
mean, for God's sakes, you get into a round table with everybody still living and you're like, who's going to be the
next? Half of these people should die.
Who's
going to
be the ruler of the realm?
The first.
Like, that just seems like
a. Come on. Six seasons are probably the best six seasons you could have on television.
Yes.
But one of the reasons it was so good is it was ruthless.
Yes.
It was ruthless. And I feel like House of Dragon, from what I've seen a little bit in the clips and what I've heard, it seems like they're getting back to that ruthlessness.
Yes.
But it's like the teeth got taken away from the show. And part of the reason is these idiots were starting to focus on a Star Wars thing that they ended up
lame,
not even
though,
doing.
How lame is it to literally just like, all right, we have to put a bow on this thing and we have to do it quick. All right, let's just do a round table with everybody where they decide who's
going to
be
the, scissors
who's
for the, realm.
Be the new king.
Yeah.
Who's gonna sit on the Iron Throne?
Yeah. It was highly disappointing. I think a huge issue
I could not.
It drives me crazy.
There was no way for me to back that up.
It drives me nuts that George, and this will be my last point on Game of Thrones, it drives me nuts that he talks about that final season with disdain because they had to ask him what the ending was to get the show rights. Like, they had to guess the ending and talk to him about it. My theory is the reason he still hasn't finished those damn books and will never finish those damn books is this was the ending he was going to do, and the fans were turned against it so much, he's like, I don't know what to do now with the books.
Yeah.
That's my theory on it. So he needs to stop talking about it.
But I also think there is a point, though, when you run out of copy to follow.
Oh, absolutely.
When you run out of a book,
once it came off of the books. Right.
Well, stop.
Once it got off of the books is when it started going down.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it.
That's how every show is, though, when you do that. You cannot try to write something for TV that's not written in a book when you have an entire series based on books.
Shogun season 2?
Yeah, that's why I'm going to watch it.
I'm nervous. Oh,
I'm nervous.
See, I'm part of the problem because I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it, but I don't think I want it.
Right. No, I hear you. But let's go ahead and grab a break. And when we come back, we will get into hour number 3. And we'll start talking some NBA Finals with my guy Keith Smith from SpotTrack and from Front Office Show right here on 92.9 FM ESPN. They're the Clippers fans of the football world there in L.A. But I thought that was really cool. You need to get over it, though.
I need to get over the old anxiety. I think part of it, too, is, though, the season got a bit spoiled for me because it's hard to avoid clips when, you know, I'm in movie and TV Twitter as much as I am. It's very difficult to avoid clips, especially when I'm not super concerned about being spoiled with it. But I know what happened in the last episode with somebody flying a dragon and then another dragon showed up. And
yes.
And that happened.
And then
I will say my mouth dropped when I saw that whenever I watched that clip. That was absolutely insane. So it seems like the next season, correct me if I'm wrong, is just going to be two blonde people raining terror upon
there's going to be bloodbath
the realm.
It's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bloodbath. But that's what Game of the Main comes
Have on. You ever experienced watching Game of Thrones with somebody for the first time that doesn't know what's about to happen? Isn't it a glorious experience? Oh, really? Yeah, I did it with Kat. It was awesome.
It's so great.
I will never forget. So when I started watching Game of Thrones, it was still when I was at the University of Tennessee. I was a sophomore. I was living in the fraternity house. And my roommate, Adrian, shout out Adrian. Yo, Adrian, we got snowed in. It was that huge snowstorm that happened, you know, I guess 9-8 years ago now. And we got snowed in, and I was like, you know what? I've never watched Game of Thrones. I need to. And I think it was only in season 5 at this time, if I was going to guess correctly. But Adrian had seen it before. So when we started watching it together, the reason I would know something bad was going to happen is I would just notice him staring at me.
Yes.
Like, all of a sudden, it was great to have him there because it's so confusing to try to talk about Game of Thrones and to get the lore and to get all the history.
Right.
So he would pause it and explain things, and he was an unbelievable resource to have while I was watching it. But I will never forget. See, at the end of season 1, I think I said a comment about, like, loving Ned Stark, and he was just like, uh-oh. And
yes,
I was like, what do you mean, uh-oh?
Yeah.
And then when the red thing happened, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who may not have seen it. It still feels like something
that you
could spoil.
Damn dog just died, like in real life.
Dude, we started the episode, and he never stopped looking at me. And I was like, what is about to happen right now? And then when it happened, thank God we were snowed in already. I don't think I talked to somebody. I think I went silent for 24 hours. It was like watching your family die on screen. It was horrific.
Your hero dying.
Well, you're just like
the main protagonist.
All
that
of your
you
favorite characters are just gone.
The one thing I will say about Game of Thrones that just like
it's the noise.
The thing about Game of Thrones is obviously it's tragic. Don't get it twisted. But like the character arcs and the who you want to win never actually wins. And then when that person wins, and I know I'm speaking in generalities. When that person wins, you're like, damn, should we have wanted her to win, Khaleesi, the entire time? My favorite moment, though, watching it back when my wife was watching it for the first time, is her loving Khaleesi through the entire thing and, like, you know, seeing how much tragedy she has gone through this entire time. Then she takes over the city and burns everybody to the ground. And the look on my wife's face of just absolute terror, like my hero just turned into a villain directly before my eyes.
Man, in the moment.
It's insane.
I was trying to defend that last season in the moment because I'm the type.
No, I couldn't.
But I couldn't. I just couldn't.
I mean, for God's sakes, you get into a round table with everybody still living and you're like, who's going to be the
next? Half of these people should have died.
Who's
going
to be the ruler
of
the realm?
The first.
Like, that just seems like a.
The first six seasons are probably the best six seasons you could have on television.
Yes.
But one of the reasons it was so good is it was ruthless.
Yes.
It was ruthless. And I feel like House of Dragon, from what I've seen a little bit in the clips and what I've heard, it seems like they're getting back to that ruthlessness.
Yes.
But it's like the teeth got taken away from the show. And part of the reason is these idiots were starting to focus on a Star Wars thing that they ended up
lame,
not even
though,
doing.
How lame is it to literally just like, all right, we have to put a bow on this thing and we have to do it quick. All right, let's just do a round table with everybody where they decide who's going to
be the new king.
Who's going to sit on the Iron Throne?
Yeah. It was highly disappointing. I think a huge issue
I could not.
It drives me crazy.
There was no way for me to back that up.
It drives me nuts that George, and this will be my last point on Game of Thrones, it drives me nuts that he talks about that final season with disdain because they had to ask him what the ending was to get the show rights. Like, they had to guess the ending and talk to him about it. My theory is the reason he still hasn't finished those damn books and will never finish those damn books is this was the ending he was going to do, and the fans were turned against it so much, he's like, I don't know what to do now with the books.
Yeah.
That's my theory on it. So he needs to stop talking about it.
But I also think there is a point, though, when you run out of copy to follow.
Oh, absolutely.
When you run out of a book,
once it came off of the books. Right.
Well, stop.
Once it got off of the books is when it started going down.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it.
That's how every show is, though, when you do that. You cannot try to write something for TV that's not written in a book when you have an entire series based on books.
Shoshogun season two?
Yeah, that's why I'm going to watch it.
I'm nervous.
I'm nervous.
See, I'm part of the problem because I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it, but I don't think I want it.
Right. No, I hear you. But let's go ahead and grab a break. And when we come back, we will get into hour number three. And we'll start talking some NBA Finals with my guy Keith Smith from SpotTrack and from Front Office Show right here on 92.9 FM ESPN.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr Sides and Bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.